Carl very kindly. Did a little digging around on Nietzsche. Remember we talked about Nietzsche and his sister. You want to relate your findings, Carl?
Well, this book came out in 1950.
Well, here I have the photocopy. 52.
1950. Called My Sister and I. And that's the one that...
Oh, yeah.
That, 51, that's the one that Edinger refers to in what Gary sent us. And a guy who's a Nietzsche scholar, primarily from the philosophical point of view, by the name of Kaufman, reviewed this book in 52 and did a partisan review article in which he pretty much exposes it, to his own satisfaction at least, that it's a hoax. This book that Kathy's holding is a hoax. I thought the review made some pretty good sense. And since then, another book has come out, which I haven't, I ordered it, for some reason I haven't gotten it yet, by the name of Walter Stanley, exploring the possibility of it being a hoax or not. And that's pretty much where it stands.
You haven't seen that book yet, have you?
No, I ordered it the same time I got this right away. There are plenty of copies of My Sister and I out there. And there are some very suspect things about the writing, I think.
Are there?
I mean, you know, we can all take a look at it. So, and the provenance of the material, the fact that this translation was done 60 years after it was supposedly written, it had been, quote, smuggled out of Jena, or is it Jena?
Jena, I think.
Jena.
German.
It had been smuggled out of Jena when Nietzsche spent his 1 year, or whatever he was there, in order to avoid his sister and mother, because they would have, of course, seized it. And then wasn't published until 1950 in a translation by a guy named Oscar Levy, and no one has any historical knowledge of it, seems. And the original manuscript has disappeared. The original German manuscript has, of course, disappeared. Levy, in talking with Kaufman, said that, well, it was probably seized by government authorities. I can't remember what he said in that article, but somebody probably broke into his house and took it. It makes this book look somewhat circum, somewhat. I don't know what you call it.
Is this the book that...
It's a hoax, I think. Probably. I don't know.
Just reading a few of the passages a minute ago, it doesn't even sound like him.
It sounds like a third-rate imitation, and... I don't know, but Edinger picked up on it, and I'm wondering somewhat uncritically, or maybe he knows more than we do. I don't know.
Well, I sent you the photocopy, right? It just, this paragraph strikes me as so genuine, and whether how anyone could have come up with it is itself a problem. I'll read you what's in the book.
This is a quote from My Sister and I?
Yeah. This is, he references it to page 184 in My Sister and I, and in Science of the Soul, it's page 52. Of all the books in the Bible, 1 Samuel, especially in the opening passages, made the profoundest impression on me. In a way, it may be responsible for an important spiritual element in my life. It is where the Lord three times wakes the infant prophet in his sleep, and Samuel three times mistakes the heavenly voice for the voice of Eli asleep near him in the temple. Convinced after the third time that his prodigy is being called to higher services, than those available to him in the house of sacrifices, Eli proceeds to instruct him in the ways of prophecy. I had no Eli, not even a Schopenhauer, when similar visitation darkened the opening days of my adolescence. I was all of 12 when the Lord broke in on me, in all his glory, a glaring fusion of the portraits of Abraham, Moses, and the young Jesus in our family Bible. In the second visitation, he came to me not physically, but in a shudder of consciousness in which good and evil both clamored before the gates of my soul for equal mastery. The third time he sees me in front of my house in the gasp of a terrible wind, I recognize the agency of a divine force, because it was in that moment that I conceived of the Trinity as God the Father, God the Son, and God the Devil. Well, that sounds like Nietzsche.
Yeah, but to play the devil's advocate,
yeah.
I think that this Levi, whoever he was, probably was a good Jewish scholar.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that he picked Samuel from the Old Testament, or you know, he had his own studies and might have spoken to him. And I think Levi is perhaps, this is my theory here, perhaps at his most inspired at this point in writing his folks, and is drawing upon some things that he personally felt, you know, as an adolescent. And is projecting them in onto Nietzsche here.
It could be.
And he's read enough of Nietzsche, including possibly Kaufman's book, to know that this final line, God the Father, the Son, and the Devil, is a good Nietzsche line. I need to throw it in there. That's an alternative theory. Okay.
Well, we don't know, but I thought we at least bring it up for discussion.
At any rate, this other book has come out, and I'm waiting to get it. But it's basically kind of a usual mystery.
It's tangential to our work, but Nietzsche was so important to Jung, I thought it'd be relevant just to look at it for a second. So.
Well, Edinger's idea that Nietzsche was still sufficiently in his right mind that he could have written this book is an interesting idea.
Yeah, well, now that's another whole question. What did Nietzsche die of? And I've got a friend who's a psychiatrist, and I'm going to run this by her. As far as I know, the tertiary stage of syphilis is short. And Nietzsche lived for
11 years.
Yeah, I was going to say 10. And that doesn't fit with, I don't think that fits the profile of tertiary syphilis. It does fit the profile of schizophrenia. So,
because Robert Schumann had tertiary syphilis.
Did he? And how long did he last, you know?
3 years.
He lasted 3 years.
Once he went into the
asylum.
Poor man was tortured by choruses of what started out as angels would turn into devils. And he was just, they were singing music and he was trying to, it was just driving him crazy, trying to write it all down. And Brahms, of course, stayed very dedicated to him the whole time and took care of the family and visited him, and it must have been very difficult to watch, but I think it was 3 years that he was gone.
I think that's a little long, but
there are some medical students that took notes of on Nietzsche when he was in the asylum, and their observations are recorded, and I think it's in some good European, and maybe in this other fires and reading by Krell, which he does not sound like someone who's got an active ongoing mental process.
Oh.
Even at that stage. He's very sunk into himself and visited terse observations. He'd say things like, I'm a university professor.
Yeah, the guy who shared from in Jena is Otto Binswanger, whose son was Ludwig Binswanger, whose daughter was on our curatorium, Hilda Binswanger. They're all gone. But it's interesting to say, did Grandpa ever talk about Nietzsche? But that, of course,
opportunities go.
Well, anyway, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but yeah. I do want to give us a chance to air out different ideas. So we stop on page 335, but just a quick review. We spent a fair amount of time last week on this business of the soul slash bird and the earth, which is something we'd seen all throughout the previous part of the book. I think why that's so important is, as far as I can see, nobody else has a dynamic view of the spirit like Jung, that there's this other source of information in the collective unconscious. And Jung is trying to reconcile how do you listen to that and be a responsible citizen, a loving partner, a good father, and all that sort of thing. Because it's the nature of that spirit to pull you out of time and space. It's an eternal truth. But unfortunately, we're not eternal beings. We're time-bound beings. We have to live in time and space. So that took up some time. And then we talked about him on 335, the second column, hauling the dead. I'm not really sure what he exactly meant by that. A couple of possibilities I just ran by myself. What has been lost in his own personal life and has to be brought back. I don't think that's the major thing. What would be the deaths in the World War I were somehow haunting him at this time. And we'll see him soon come to the realization that what he's dealing with is a collective process, not just a personal process. That you could say the war has erupted in himself psychologically. That's a possibility. Another possibility is that we've seen earlier where when he's about to give up on religion, the dead return. And that was when he was reading Imitation of Christ. If you remember that, he's reading Imitation of Christ. He's like, oh, this is terrible. I can't stomach this stuff. And he's about ready to throw it all out, and then the dead return. And the dead there were the past forms that have held an important place in the minds of citizenry throughout history, and that had been disregarded as superstitions or, you know, false beliefs and so on. And he's realizing that the forms themselves need to be reinterpreted. They've died because the way they expressed themselves in a previous age is no longer relevant for us. We don't worry about trying to transform base metals into gold. But what Jung does then is say, okay, that is a basic pattern. How is it alive? And in what form should it be alive in our time? And of course he comes up with alchemy. So they were the basic few points we talked about. And then we got as far as second column on 335, a little bit more halfway down, where he says, what have you noticed? Everybody see where we are. I have to confess, some of this I don't understand. So we'll have to try to work on it together. Some of it I think I do. Some of it's kind of repetitive, so we can go fast at those points. So it'll be a mixture of trying to explain what I think I understand, and then me saying, I don't know what the heck this guy's driving at. And sometimes I like to say, well, we've done this before. So what he's dealing with now is the effect of his insights on his humanity. And what he's saying is, you know, what if I really listen to all this stuff, what's that going to do to me? It's going to pull me away from average thinking, and the world likes people who think in an average way, so it's going to cost me friends. It's about to cost him his professional community, because he'll resign from the Psychoanalytic Association. It certainly must have put a kink in his marriage. I think Emma Jung was amazingly broad-minded, but I'm sure she wasn't happy with all that was going on. And so that's what he's dealing with. And he's saying, you know, I doubt because of my love for men. So he's wondering if what he has just heard is relevant, and it scares him that it could affect, this is how I read it, it scares him that it could affect his warmth toward other people.
What specifically?
All these ideas he's just heard, and the fact that he's being called to talk about them. And in fact, it did. I mean, they did. What he doesn't know yet is that those ideas will reconnect him back on a different level to a whole other group of people. He doesn't know that yet. So he's thinking, as I mentioned last week, last time, you know, God, I have everything laid out for me. I got this nice wife, I got these beautiful kids, I got this marvelous house. I have a position at the university people would kill for. I'm a well-known psychiatrist. Why can't I be happy with that? And he's giving all of that up and asking himself, is it worth it? Or am I just crazy? And at that time, he doesn't know that it will lead somewhere. And I'm sure any of you who have mucked around in reading psychology know this is what screwed up people do. They get everything, and then they blow it. I mean, look at politicians who have ruined their careers over stupid mistakes. Business leaders who have ruined their lives over sexual indiscretions and so on. And he's asking himself, am I in the same boat? And he was not, but he didn't know it at the time. So that's what's going on, I think, pretty much for the rest of that column, at least that paragraph. The soul voice is kind of hard on him when it says there is a divine and a human intention. Well, the divine intention would be all the things he's just heard. And the human intention would be that he just wants to go down to the pub, have a beer with the guys like everybody else. And that really is not resolved at that point. But what he gets then is this idea, a couple of sentences in the next paragraph, I wanted to understand it all as personal experiences within me, and consequently I can neither understand nor believe it all since my belief is weak. Now that's anticipating what he's going to say pretty soon. I realized when the war broke out that I was being attacked by thoughts that the historical situation has evoked and which I need to articulate for the sake of humanity. People don't want to hear it because they don't want to deal with the causes of violence. And then he gets into a little discussion of belief versus knowledge. And that's one way, I think, to understand these scrutinies, that there are certain themes that appear. And the new theme now is belief versus knowledge. And I don't know if we need to go into all the details over to 336. He essentially says knowledge is more important than belief. But he has to believe in his experiences. But those experiences are a form of knowledge. He certainly is arguing against, you know, do you believe in God? Religion as belief. He wants knowledge. And that is the wrestling he's doing with himself. I have to believe in what I just experienced, though knowledge is more important than belief. So what I have to do is take an attitude toward my experience to test whether or not it's true, so that his experience can be ascertained as knowledge.
Belief that isn't based on knowledge would be faith?
Yeah, right. Right. Again, these are side issues. We've done this before.
So this is like blind belief versus...
Yes.
Sort of, in a... Not in a clear way, but the scientific method.
Yes.
Of gathering knowledge from experience,
right,
and applying,
yeah,
that to...
Yeah.
Theory.
Now, again, remember, he's just working on his ideas. Later, it is that he distinguishes between scientific and empirical.
But, you know, when you're dealing with the inner world, most people would not consider those,
right,
scientific experiences.
Right. Okay. He does.
Okay.
Okay? Not too hard. Then we're about the middle of 336, first column. The next big theme that comes up is solitude. What's it going to cost me? She answered, as you already know, I have long predicted solitude for you. You need not be afraid of madness. What I predict is valid.
This is his soul talking.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Now, again, you know, as we'll see coming up, you can't listen to these inner figures without discernment. So that's not quite true, what she's saying. He had a very rich family surrounding him. He had lots of friends. But in a sense, he was a lonely man because he couldn't talk to, he could talk to very few people who could follow him. And so it might be more accurate if she had said, I have long predicted a kind of solitude for you. But these figures speak in absolutes. But still, he's wrestling with what's it going to cost him to say this stuff. And that solitude to him also means violating the human pact. That I'm a social being, and I need a social community, and to exist in solitude is to betray my community. My community needs me. The community needs each of us. But I think that's one thing he just had to accept. It does isolate him somewhat, and that's what he's struggling with here. As I say, I think these figures put it too black and white, but there is a grain, there is not more than a grain, there is truth in what she says. But later events will show that this was his way back to the world.
Doesn't he say, I want to say some memories, dreams, and reflections, that you are required to break off from the community of people, but the guilt of that must be repaid by bringing something back.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Otherwise, if you just break off, then the guilt is intact.
Yeah.
You can't just break off. You have to break off and then bring something back.
Absolutely. That's the resolution of this. I'm sure he kept that. Yeah. And you think, you know, of somebody like Van Gogh, who broke off, never did get back. Not because he didn't do his work. And it drove him crazy. And I think this is what Jung is afraid of.
Well, he did have his brother, right? Didn't Van Gogh have his brother?
Yeah.
Through letters, maybe.
Yeah, and he had friends here and there, but...
But still, to be accepted.
To be accepted. Mm-hmm. And you know, you think what his paintings sold for then versus what they sell for now and the lack of recognition. that takes a toll.
Didn't Gauguin want him to paint like Gauguin?
Mm-hmm.
I know they ended up quarreling. Was that over...
I think that was part of it.
Partly. And the other part was that Van Gogh was just so difficult and acted crazy and tore things up.
Right.
And
yeah. It might have been a good answer to me.
Well, remember they had that exhibit in Chicago about 10 or 12 years ago. You see it of Van Gogh and Gauguin side by side, there's no comparison.
No.
There is no comparison. I looked at Gauguin and I moved. The same side by side, wow. You know, I worked, another quick detour, I worked with delinquent kids when I was in graduate school, and this was in California. I worked at a school for delinquent kids. And on Sundays, Fridays, we take field trips. And we try to do something like cultural, because most of the time they're getting in fights and smoking dope, God knows what else. So I would take them to the San Francisco Museum of Art from time to time. Those kids would make a beeline to the Van Gogh every time. It just resonated, and they just go, wow. And they'd sit there, stand there quietly, absorbing this painting. So anyway, quick detour.
Well, if anyone can express the spirit and matter,
it's Van Gogh. It's Van Gogh, yeah.
Every little line, is like it's alive,
mm-hmm.
I think.
But you said you find yourself more moved by it again.
No, by Van Gogh.
He has spoken.
I have been moved by Gauguin when I saw him separately.
I see.
But when I saw him side by side,
the comparison,
there was no comparison. It was looking at it like looking at a. Well, I don't want to insult his work, but there was a great difference in quality. Not in painting technique, but in emotional vitality. That continues to the end of that first column. Couple of important statements. He says, I fear committing an injustice to men if I go my own way.
Gary, above that, she speaks of abandonment, or he refers to her speaking of abandonment.
Yeah.
And I get confused about exactly what was meant by abandoning the world.
Where is that?
It's just above that statement that you just read. Two lines up. Did I not speak to you of abandonment, of leaving me? She's talking about, like, sacrifice, the size of the sacrifice that's required.
I think she's saying, you know, yeah, I said it's going to be a rough road.
Okay.
I said you're going to be abandoned. Now deal with it.
Okay. That type of abandonment.
I think
not
so.
That he needed to abandon himself.
I don't think so.
Process.
No.
Okay. I took it as he needed to abandon the world and all the traditional thinking.
Yeah, either his abandonment of the world or the feeling of being abandoned by the world if he withdraws his intention purely into his own work. But then she says, you have laid your hand on the divine, which those have not. After that, that's the next paragraph. And by divine, here I would say, you know, the point of view of the collective unconscious, which he earlier called the spirit of the depths. Remember that at the very beginning of the word, spirit of the depths versus spirit of the times. And as I take it, there really, you know, there is something going on that is causing history. And we prefer not to look at it. That's the spirit of the times. And so history happens, and we throw up our hands. Oh, how did that happen? And what he is seeing is the forces that have moved history. And since people don't want to take responsibility as a human race for our destroying ourselves, his truth is rejected. And, you know, in university settings today, you cannot say, well, this is the way things are. You get crucified. You have to say, this is how I see things are. This is the narrative I espouse. And what Jung is saying is completely contradictory to that. There really is something going on, and we really can know it. And if he articulates it, it's going to cost him. Then he's worried, am I deceiving myself? I could not accept these words since I fear deception. So it's just, it's the struggle over, can I trust what I've seen? Can I, if I speak what I have seen, what will it cost me? What if I'm wrong? What's that going to do to my family? And so on. And then, second column, 336, an anchorite appears. An old man with a white beard, see where I am, about one, two, three, four, five, six lines down. The anchorite, remember, where the anchorites were the early Christians who went into the desert because they felt they had to get away from the world, since the world was so hostile to their Christian views. And the only way to remain true to their Christian views was to separate from the world, which is probably true. And Jung is feeling somewhat in the same boat. Am I going to have to separate from the world to stay true to my point of view? And what I referred to earlier is what the anchorite says. I am a nameless one, one of the many who lived and died in solitude. The spirit of the times and the acknowledged truth required this from us. Look at me, you must learn this. Things have been too good for you. Again, overstated. Somewhat histrionic. But at the time, that's the way it looked. In retrospect, and as you, I guess no one has memories here by any chance, do they? Memory streams? I think it's the last page he says, I'm surprised how much success my work brought me and the community that it linked me to. Is that in the last page there, Anne? Or one of the last pages? Very, very end.
In fact, it seems to me as if the alienation which so long separated me from the world has become transferred into my own inner world and has revealed to me unexpected unfamiliarity with myself.
Doesn't it go on and say, and it brought me, I'm surprised about the success it brought me?
I don't see that. Let me
have a quick look. But you already hear him reevaluating the alienation theme. Now, I'm satisfied with the course my life has taken. It has been bountiful. It has given me a great deal. How could I have ever expected so much? Nothing but unexpected things kept happening to me. Much might have been different if I myself had been different, but it was as it had to be, for all came about because I am as I am. Many things worked out as I planned them, but that did not always prove to benefit to me. And so on. Well, you get a feeling that how he's reevaluated that sense of alienation at the end of his life, that it brought him bounty. But that's at the end of his life, and here he's still not clear. a little bit about science, that it's childish, it leaves much untouched, but it's the tool that we have to use.
Is this the anchorite talking to him about science?
Let me see. I get lost if he said what. Yes. Now, that reference is to scholasticism.
And science.
Right. Because Jung has this interesting idea that Christianity is exactly what gave birth to science. Romans could have never been scientists because they were too dishonest. But Christianity expressed values of truthfulness. And then as we moved in the Middle Ages, would it be Thomas Aquinas, I think, began the work of reconciling reason and faith. To the development of reason. And science is simply that capacity of the development of reason developed through Christian thinkers being applied to solving world problems. So that the Christian viewpoint actually is the basis of science, in the sense of truthfulness and clear thinking. So I think that's why the anchorite and science are seen as compatible here. But remember, this is all confusion. It doesn't make sense because it doesn't make sense. He's running 1,000 thoughts through his head. And we can retrospect, say, well, here's the conclusion he reached out of it. But at this point, he's still confused about all the questions. And then I think a statement which supports that is, I did not know what work was mine since everything was dark. I got the powerful statement right there. And he really wouldn't know until 1928, when he got the text from Richard Wilhelm and slowly began to discover how alchemy illustrated his experiences. Now, I have no clue what about these little aphorisms. You got an idea, I'm open. The hand that strikes first strikes best, nonsense streams from the deepest wells. They have to be like the now, morning is more beautiful than night, flowers smell until they fade, and so on. Where that comes from, I don't know. And he also says he didn't know either. The only thing I can come up with is, and this may be really stretching the point, that you got to be careful about the unconscious giving pat answers.
Well, he does preface this with, he was struck with the fear of madness when he heard it.
Keep going. What would you make of that, Carol?
Well, these things are the obvious in life being pronounced as the deepest insights. That's how they strike you. These things are the obvious things in life being presented as the deepest possible insights, like Proverbs.
Yeah, and so what? And ergo, what conclusion would you draw from that?
But he has to be very careful of this old man's idea of science,
yeah,
and figure out for himself what is science,
yeah,
and what is not science,
okay,
and how can I use science.
Yeah, I think we agree then.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, maybe in being afraid, at least I tend to go back. I keep going back and comparing things to Scripture because that's where I was for so long. And maybe he's just trying to get something to hang on to.
That could be too. Yeah. Any case.
So they seem like pompous truisms.
Yeah.
You know, how can you, like Carol says, how can you take the old man seriously if this is always,
right.
This is always good for
him? Right. Right.
So the old man came to him and said science was too childish. Then the old man faded away and some time passed where he was in an endless sadness and depression. Nothing spoke to him, and when the old man comes back, he's basically spouting a lot of gibberish.
Not quite. I would say partial gibberish, partial truth. This is the problem.
But it's more nonsensical.
I don't think so, no.
It's an old man, too. We don't know if it's the same old man.
Yeah, well, I'm going by the footnote.
The footnote corrects him with the anchorite that was earlier in the book, right?
Yeah.
And that anchorite, he won, gave him... He ended up with the idea that there were certain valuable things in Christianity that he had to carry forward.
Right.
But not everything.
But not everything. And the
this
danger,
is another sorting out.
Yeah.
Now it's science.
Yeah. And what we're not used to thinking is how Christianity and science are two sides of the same coin.
Well, it seems like the Romans had it all over the Christians with science. I mean, they were really...
Practical science.
They had some pretty amazing techniques.
What they got from the Greeks.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, I think they,
and they made their own
buildings,
too.
Building roads and
aqueducts. Yeah, well, I think what Ewan is getting at, that the kind of discipline that is required for extensive scientific inquiry couldn't have been mustered by the Romans.
Well, I suppose the Romans weren't in favor of anything that wasn't manly, and thinking, too much thinking wasn't manly.
Yeah, and an organized, these scientific communities are almost like churches.
So we're talking maybe practical versus theoretical science.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, but theoretical, the thing, when I say Christianity and science are two sides of the same coin, I mean, they reside in a very similar, in very similar mental processes. That's what he's trying to get at, I think. And like with religion, take it and don't take it. Science, take it and don't take it. That's what he's dealing with in all of these issues. I can't get rid of any of them, and I can't subscribe to any of them. And that's what he's thrashing about. Again, today, these are non-issues for us that work in Jungian psychology. But they were issues for him. 1914.
I guess what is striking me, and I'm not clear why, is when you talk Christianity or science, you're talking about a very linear way of thinking. And at the first part of this, the anchorite seemed fairly linear and was making an argument that seemed to have a flow to it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this part is not that kind of a linear argument. So maybe that is what's coming up, that you can have a thought process that is scientific and linear, or religious argument that is scientific, or that is linear, or you can have this other type of truth that on the surface seems nonsensical, but yet if you look at it, more of the spiral and the way he wrote later in his...
No, you're onto something.
I don't know. I can't... something is important here.
Yeah.
I can pick up on that, but I can't organize my thoughts.
Well, you helped me see something. I'm with you, but I would give a different conclusion. And that is that science and rationality, which is our main tool, in the deepest sense, is an aphorism. It's simply one, it's an opinion about what knowledge is. Scientist says, we're knowledge. Jung is saying, no, you're an opinion about what knowledge is. That's the big difference, I think. That's how I link the two.
Or an experience. One experience of what knowledge is. And knowledge can come from many types of
exactly.
experience.
Exactly. Knowledge can come from many types of experience. Or you might say, it's an opinion about what knowing is.
But it's an outer knowing.
It's an outer knowing. It has rules that are conducive to understanding. It has rules that are conducive to denial. Remember my story about the doctor and diabetes? I worked with a guy, and we got rid of his diabetes through analysis. For a couple of years, he came back. I was telling the doctor this, and I said, and that's a fact. He said, no, it's not. It's an anecdote.
He said, what?
Anecdote. See, a fact is only what's repeatable. Well, that leaves out all of the emotional experiences from science's inquiry that are not repeatable, which happen to be the most important things in life. So Jung, I think, is moving toward the recognition of what science, how science is important and how science is limited, both. His answer, which he will come up with later, is empiricism. Just because something isn't repeatable doesn't mean it's not important psychologically. And I can't demonstrate the repeatability of facts, but I can record them and present them in case studies. A hard-nosed scientist will not accept that, quote-unquote. A creative scientist will accept that. Because science has always moved forward by looking at facts it can't explain. Now, this is Jung many years later.
But never taking into consideration the inner part of the whole thing.
Yeah.
You know, their attitude, their that has an effect.
And now quantum mechanics is
right.
throwing that into question.
Right.
Yeah. Remember, this is 100 years ago.
That explains, there's too much childishness in it.
Yeah. It's really, it's as much a system of knowledge as it is a system of denial.
But it also explains your earlier time religious or the church and science, because the true scientist is not going to deny those facts that don't fit with his theory. He's
right.
going to leave open the possibility that there is a different theory, an overarching theory that can interpret those as well.
Yeah, right. And see, all that hasn't really occurred to you yet. Again, we're seeing things we take for granted in their very first appearance. And then this, I think, really important paragraph. The Sabbath did not leave until the 24th of June, 1914. And the night my soul spoke to me, the greatest comes from the smallest. After this, nothing further was said, and then the war broke out. That was in August, if I remember. This opened my eyes about what I had experienced before, and it also gave me the courage to say all that which I have written in the earlier part of this book. So in a way, all that doubt is getting resolved. and that he sees how important his work is for the human community.
Would we call that a synchronicity?
I guess he would, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, because he had had all those dreams and images of the war.
Well, it's almost as though his experience was synchronistic with the world. The conscious of the world that was leading to the war.
Certainly, there is nothing in science that can explain that. Well, we got through number three. Do you have a stretch?
Yeah.